Hi, everybody. This is Micha Sifri from Personal Democracy Media, and we're back with another of our ongoing teleconferences that we call Personal Democracy Plus, the ongoing discussions with movers, shakers, thinkers, doers, innovators at the intersection where technology is colliding with and changing politics, government, and civic life. And today we're going to be looking at the question of whether the personalized web is hurting democracy and what those invisible but very, very powerful organizations known as ad networks and media buyers, what they are doing with all that information that they collect about us as we surf the web and go blithely on our way, not realizing how we may be being tracked and targeted and segregated. And to guide us through this world, we're going to be joined by Professor Joseph Thoreau, who is the author of a very interesting new book, The Daily You, where he gets into the behind-the-scenes picture of how this information universe that most of us pay very, very little attention to, but that both publishers and advertisers are more and more really having to pay a lot of attention to, how it subtly shapes the experience that we have online and may also be undermining some very, very important institutions and values that we perhaps have taken too much for granted about how information works in this new networked age. So with all that said, Joe, welcome to the call. And you know, why don't you, you know, start out and tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to write The Daily You, and then maybe, you know, really give us a little bit of the history. I mean, the brave new world you're describing, how did this all come about in the first place?
You want how did I come about or how did the brave new world
well,
come about?
Well, both. We've okay. always good to know a little bit about you first,
well,
too.
Well, I'm glad to. I've been studying this stuff for many years. Originally, I was supposed to be a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And everyone in my family thought I was going to be a lawyer. And I read something when I was in high school because I thought I'd better find out about this stuff if everyone says I'm going to be a lawyer. And I remember it was a red book, a thin book, produced by H.W. Wilson. Isn't it amazing? I remember the name of the publisher. But I read it, and I found it terribly boring for me. And the only thing I remember today from that book was the phrase stare decisis. And I thought, gee, I'm not really interested in this. What can I do? I was very upset for a while figuring out what I wanted to do in life. And I said, somebody must be interested. And I used to watch a lot of TV. Mm-hmm. And I said, somebody must write these commercials. So I got extraordinarily interested in advertising and wanted to be an advertising copywriter. And I went to the branch of the Brooklyn Public Library near my house and literally read everything that was on the bookshelf about advertising. I became fascinated by it. When I was 17, I got a subscription to Advertising Age because my father knew someone who was working for Crane Communication. Anyway, I ended up going to grad school. I majored in English, then grad school, and then I stuck around for my PhD and decided to study media industries rather than work in them. And for numbers of years, I did a lot of work in Hollywood looking at the sort of sociology of the television industry. But then when I got back in the 90s, I was here at Penn, and I thought, gee, there are lots of things going on in the advertising industry. And I began to study that. And I've written now three books on what really is – a transformation taking place in the advertising industry that's resonating through our society and through the larger globe, actually. And my first book, Breaking Up America, was about the social implications of target marketing. And this was in the mid-90s. And the second book, called Niche Envy, which 2006, I guess, was about the social implications of database marketing. Sort of taking that to another level, taking Breaking Up America to another level. What this book is about, The Daily You, is really about the process of what's going on, the transformation of the advertising industry in such a major way that it's ping-ponging around our entire way of seeing the world, I would argue, and certainly have major ramifications for the kinds of media that we have. Most people tend to think of advertising in terms of the content that we see. You know, and something like the Super Bowl. You watch the Super Bowl. I watch them for the commercials. You know,
so
and,
do I.
Yeah, and it's great, and there's a lot of discourse about it, and there's an entire literature in the humanities and social sciences around the ads that we see. I'm very interested in that and fascinated by the history of advertising, but I think what we've often missed in talking about advertising is the basic point that what the advertising industry does is it is the support system for many of the dominant media in our society, meaning that advertisers pay an enormous amount to reach us, and in doing that, they support media like radio, like television, like magazines and newspapers and outdoor boards and so much else that we often don't think about. And that basic fact is what intrigues me and what is at the core of a lot of the work I've been doing recently. Because the decision to put money on one medium is a decision not to put money on another medium. And the movement away from even basic advertising to, say, public relations or other kinds of what they call marketing services is a decision to support media in ways other than simply giving these companies money. And so what we're seeing in society today is a transformation of that, the transformation of what it means to support media and how it's done. And that's really where I started.
Right. And, you know, most of us, I think, have certainly heard about the fact that some traditional news media is facing, you know, a tremendous disruption in their business model. You know, the classified ads disappeared first, but the, you know, the audience is migrating away from sites where you have to pay, you know, to access information and towards free content, and the result is a, you know, publishers, newspaper publishers in particular, you hear about, but it isn't just them, are being forced out of business or cutting back drastically. You know, they make nowhere near as much money from online advertising as they do from, you know, print advertising. But you're saying that this is just the tip of a much more serious iceberg that our whole society is hitting, not just the newspaper industry itself.
Right.
So talk about that.
What I try to do in the book is explain how that happened and what, what's going on. To start, we have to think about the notion that the history of the 20th century really was a history in teaching society that content is cheap because people, advertisers are paying for it. At least 70-80% of much of the newspapers are covered historically by ads. Half of magazines, for example, we were so used to many years getting TV content for free, that kind of thing. Now, what happened in the 1980s, into the 80s, was a fractionalization of media. As I'm sure many of the people on this call know, we had the entry of cable television in the beginning in the 80s, a small number of new channels that were not broadcast, and then by the 90s, 150 channels. That was paralleled by a total reorganization, and we can't go into a whole lot of detail, I do in the book, of the advertising industry's media buying and planning business. Initially, media buying and planning was a kind of backwater in advertising. Companies, even big companies, would make a lot of money off of it. They would get a slice of the amount that their clients would pay for it as part of their revenues. But what would happen was, you know, if P&G or Unilever or whatever had to do ads, they had a couple of basic choices. It was television, maybe women's magazines, and a few other things, maybe, you know, maybe newspapers, you know, maybe a few outdoor ads. But mainly it was easy thinking, and they used to hire people at relatively low salaries to do this stuff. With the multiplication of channels, you began to have a whole new way of thinking about this. It was paralleled by the rise of what are called agency conglomerates, and most people don't even know they exist. We're talking about companies like WPP, Omnicom, Interpublic, Publicis, They control over half of the global advertising money that goes to buy media.
Mm-hmm.
And those companies began to see media planning and buying as profit centers, not simply as support for their copywriting activities, their creative
mm-hmm.
activities. So they created these standalone businesses. And the standalone media buying and planning businesses began to say, we have a competitive advantage, they all began to say this, in terms of quantitative understanding of our audiences and where they're going, okay, of our clients' audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in the 80s and into the 90s, you began to see businesses that began to buy space and time in media based on quantitative evaluations of us, okay, how they think of people in much more quantitative ways than ever before. That really took off with the rise of the internet, and particularly into the 2000s, where increasingly the ability in the digital world to track people and get information about them and then slice and dice them to the point that they appeal to certain kinds of advertisers become part of the holy grail of advertising.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
we're only in the beginning of this. You know, we shouldn't believe that we're even in the middle. We're only a decade and a half into this business. It's hard to believe that some of the biggest companies like Google and Facebook are rather young,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Foursquare and some of those. And what the goal is eventually is to be able to figure out what you want before you know you want it,
mm-hmm.
and for companies like Google and others to serve you up with information, ads, discounts, and also, I would argue, entertainment and news, catering to your particular, to their ideas of your particular notions of the world.
Mm-hmm.
This is very different from the kind of utopian idea that people like Nicholas Negroponte and others have had, whereby we have the choice. Even in a dystopian way, somebody like Cass Sunstein would push the notion that is we who are segregating ourselves out based on what we want in this digital arena. You know,
mm-hmm.
we're going to look at stuff we care about and not stuff we don't care about, for example, with politics.
Right.
What's happening,
right.
and I think people don't follow this as much, is that it's not just we who are doing this. The companies are doing this for us. We don't often know that it's taking place, and we certainly don't have an idea about what companies think about us and know about us that cause us to get certain kinds of information.
Mm-hmm. Now, just for argument's sake, is this because the sort of what you might call the default settings of most people's experience of using the web? In other words, you know, the average web user probably fires up their browser and never, you know, goes into the privacy settings and says, you know, shut off cookies, shut off any ability for ads to for sites
yeah.
to track my right, so that it's some of it is simply the defaults are set to open.
Yes, it's basically an opt out world,
mm-hmm.
and even the opt out part is extremely difficult to keep your privacy. Now, there are ways to get programs that really anonymize you,
mm-hmm.
you know, and if you want to take the trouble to do that, you can. But we have to also, and they can do it in a way that really you won't be tracked. But that's not an easy thing, and people have to go out and find that and do that. The problem is that most people don't, and most
mm-hmm.
people see the web in a rather utilitarian way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the term surfing is kind of anachronistic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there are many people who really surf the web.
Mm-hmm.
When was the last time you pushed the button, I feel lucky, on Google? I did it once out of curiosity. I wasn't even sure what it was about. But
mm-hmm.
But the notion is most people go online to do something.
Yeah.
And they don't want to, and they can't often know a whole lot about what's under the hood.
Mm-hmm.
So what I try to do in the book is explain that, but that doesn't mean that it's simple to counter.
Yeah. Yeah.
It isn't.
No, it isn't. And in fact, we had a call, our previous call, just a week ago, with Chris Segoyan, who is a online
yeah.
privacy expert,
Chris.
Went into some detail about these issues that, you know, there is no premium version of Facebook you can get that, you know, defaults to the strongest
no.
privacy possible. And, you know, if you are your typical web user, you probably don't realize that, you know, the browser you're using is enabling all kinds of cookies and other tracking tools that you have to sort of actively spend time figuring out how to shut off. So that,
you know,
for
what?
Most people, this is part of, you know, the background, if you will, the background noise of everyday web use is
exactly.
That you are actually generating this huge data trail that third parties can pick up on.
And so you're absolutely right. And there's a number of things. We've been doing surveys on this since 1999 on Americans' mm-hmm. knowledge of and attitudes toward the web. And some of what we have found have been very consistent. But it is pretty well consistent, and others have found this too, that Americans know they're being tracked, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They know that advertisers are following them. What they don't understand very well is the whole idea of data mining.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, if you go to Google, for example, and you can – Google will have explanations of how this stuff works, what
mm-hmm.
they do, but they're always with unitary variables. So, for example, they'll say, we look to see that you're interested in soccer. Therefore, we might serve you an ad about soccer.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds so benign as to say, why the heck is somebody like Joe Turo worried about this stuff? And so the examples themselves are often against the notion of trying to work to stop this sort of thing, to learn more about it. Let me make another point, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
The word privacy often has so many different reverberations that I think sometimes we get lost in things, and a lot of times it allows people to make what I'm talking about sound trivial. So soccer moms or other things of that sort. Why should I care if a company knows that I'm looking for a bicycle or want to buy a car? Maybe
mm-hmm.
I'll get a relevant ad. I mean, that's certainly a legitimate thing that marketers will say.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm not against target marketing per se, and we can talk about that. But but I also want to point out that a large part of what I'm concerned about has to do with the larger notion of social discrimination. Okay. So it's not simply you that I'm being tagged as someone who's looking for a bicycle or buying a baby carriage. It's rather that what companies are doing in multiple ways are creating images of us, essentially, reputations of us, and increasingly they're going to be persistent. Sometimes they're not, you know, now, but and they're often being shared by large companies that have lots of data about where we are on the web, what we do offline. These things get interconnected with one another. And eventually we have a situation where some companies think that you're targets and other people are waste.
Mm-hmm.
And this begins to raise some very interesting issues, and I would argue sometimes socially problematical issues about what certain people get compared to other people.
Right.
What ads do I get to see? What kinds of discounts do I get compared to someone else who's not considered valuable enough? Now,
mm-hmm.
this has gone on offline, of course, for centuries.
Yeah.
In many ways, the digital age can make it even worse. There was
mm-hmm.
a time, and still exists, the idea that, you know, and we don't think about this. Do you know that it was in the 19th century that prices really for the first time in the U.S. began to be democratized with the rise
mm-hmm.
of the department store?
Mm-hmm.
So you could, for lots of reasons we can go into, people could walk into a store and everybody would see the same prices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas that's changing now. For the first time in a long time, you can get prices and not know what the other prices are simply because companies think certain things about you compared to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
They will get away with charging a higher price, or we
mm-hmm.
need this person a lower price. And this happens all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
but that's not, I mean, nearly as troubling as, you know, you're suggesting that, you know, there's this great anecdote near the beginning of the book where you talk about, you know, a hypothetical family that could, you know, based on their web surfing,
yeah.
You know, let's say they are surfing a lot, looking at, you know,
fast foods. Yeah.
You know, the next thing you know, they start seeing more ads for, you know, lower end food products. that the assumption advertisers start to make about them is that it's a family of overweight people. In subtle ways, and then even worse, that publishers who are under increasing pressure to deliver the right kinds of users to these advertisers will also begin to shape their editorial content, not just the ads, around the perceived interests of a particular user.
Yeah, right? Yes, exactly. And in fact, so in the case of cars, for example, if you go to a car site might based on what they think about you, what they know about you, iterate that you're more likely to get used cars than not used cars. Mm-hmm. And while, it's not just the car issue, it's how do you see yourself through the media you use?
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, we evaluate ourselves based on what other people think of us.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, continually, you will be seeing versions of the world that you have no idea where they're coming from, no control over, based upon what marketers have collected and inferred about you. So it's not just what they know about you, it's what they infer. So, for example, people with these characteristics would also be people like these characteristics. Probabilistic.
Right. Are there signs that – I mean, have you found any, like, really outrageous examples of this?
People have made attributions of political parties based upon the cars people drive,
mm-hmm.
okay? And one company was – deciding, giving people the ability to get mortgages or not get mortgages. They were ranking people based upon how their friends paid their mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Have you heard of Clout? KLOT.
Yep.
That's
mm-hmm.
a company that ranks people based upon the supposed persuasiveness they have, based upon what they do in social media sites.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So these are companies that are using tools to make inferences about us that have real-life consequences.
Right. Though, to be fair to some of those companies, I mean, it isn't as if cloud is that widely used or influential. It doesn't change, what your Google search result will be or something. I mean,
But there are companies that use cloud for the purposes we've just mentioned. And the Google search results, you can shut it off. But increasingly, it's based on personalization, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's now, in the last couple of years, I guess, Google personalization has been an opt-out rather than an opt-in.
Right.
So, and sometimes it's terrific. You know, you write something in and it knows exactly where you are and gives it, people can quarrel with this. But my large point is that we're in the 21st century of data mining, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The one major feature of the 21st century across so many aspects of life is going to be the mining of data.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all you have to do is go to the Obama website.
Mm-hmm.
I registered on the Obama website a few weeks ago, partly just to see what's going on, I tend to keep privacy policies. Most people don't. And it's fascinating because what they say basically is everything you tell us, we collect. We have the right to go and purchase any information we want about you.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, we'll share it with anybody we think is ideologically resonant with us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know that people who go to the Obama website and register have any clue that this kind of thing goes on. Okay? And, of course, they're not the only ones. Now, last I saw the Romney website, they were not doing that per se, not as carefully, but they hire companies that do this.
Yep.
And there are many political marketing firms allied with different parties that are specifically interested in this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So for you, one of the big worries is that the end result here is a quantum leap in the marketer, whether it's a campaign or a media buyer working on behalf of some commercial advertiser, that the person doing the marketing now has a quantum leap in their ability to A, know something about the person coming to this web page, and then B, subtly manipulating what they will see and conceivably anticipating, shaping, and you know, segregating us in ways that we're not even aware of because it's completely opaque.
Right, but it's not just one web page.
Mm-hmm.
My point is this is becoming collectively shared
mm-hmm.
by various sites across networks, across affiliates. So this is not something that is unique only to one group, one particular site. You know,
mm-hmm.
this is something that gets shared. And beyond that, the real change in this, the real kind of formative for the 21st century moment will happen when television becomes totally digital and addressable. Now, this
mm-hmm.
has been a kind of goal of marketers and TV people for a while. And if you want, we can get into how they've tried it. It hasn't worked so far. But I have no doubt that in the next several years, we'll be more and more into a world where commercials, and this is technically possible, by the way,
mm-hmm.
that commercials
mm-hmm.
can be changed on the fly based upon what they know about the household and even the individual. And technically, with the right processing power, it's possible to change a show so that somebody will look more like you, who's the hero, than someone else. Than a show that gets somebody else. So, I mean, you can imagine how this would be in audiovisual stuff. It's much more complicated. But certainly audiovisual commercials can be changed, and they're experimenting with this already, changed on the fly based upon what they know about the household.
Wow. So yep. So you're saying that if a African-American family is watching TV, they might see commercials that show more African-Americans just because marketers think it's better to make people
quite possible.
Think the product yeah. is being used by people like me.
Yes. And not only that, we're going to see the way I see this, and I really have no doubt it's going to happen. The question is when, and people always make the predictions too soon. But
mm-hmm.
when you turn on your TV, or we'll have to get into a whole discussion what TV means. But assuming we're still talking about a box, and people will still have that box, that flat screen in a main room. When you turn that on, you are not going to see a channel.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see an intelligent navigator,
mm-hmm.
which will be based partly on what you say you like, you know, giving you suggestions for the evening or whatever, and
mm-hmm.
partly based upon the iterations, the searching that you've done and the kinds of viewing that you've done.
Mm-hmm.
And not mm-hmm. and all of that will also, maybe even in an opt-in way, be shared with a variety of marketers and other actors in the process here. So you
mm-hmm.
they may say, hey, Micha, we have six shows for you that you might watch today. And by the way, Coca-Cola is willing to sponsor this one movie if you watch it because Coke really likes you.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so the monetization of this process will be that you will be saving money if you participate in the ads. And we'll
mm-hmm.
see more and more integrated advertising. Because people hate to watch ads, and more we'll see the advertising built into the programming and even into magazine articles. We're already seeing this. That's another part of what I suggest is happening here, which is the destruction of the church-state relationship, this separation between editorial and advertising. So all of this will happen in television, and once it happens in television, that's going to be the world as advertisers really want it. Particularly the major national advertisers.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to just pause here because we're at the halfway point, and invite people listening, if somebody wants to ask a question, to hit *6 on their phone. This often doesn't lead to questions right away, which is fine, give people an opportunity. And if not, I've got plenty more. You know, Joe, say a bit more about this church-state thing, because on the one hand, I think I am convinced that, something very, corrosive is underway in that as traditional publishers see their old streams of revenue, print advertising in particular, drying up and they are now under more pressure, to get eyeballs online. Even though the actual money that they can earn, the CPM is industry calls it, is much lower. That this is getting us pushing them in the direction of customizing content. But you also do point out that I mean, this is not new in the sense that back in the 1950s, you know, as commercial broadcast television took over, that, you know, advertisers, commercial advertisers did not want the content around their ads to depress people. So,
yeah.
You know, TV, you know, we didn't see that much coverage of poverty on
right.
television,
still
you know,
don't.
Starting in the 1950s. It's
right.
not like it's a new thing that TV is a wasteland. It's been a wasteland for a long time.
Well, it's an interesting issue. You're right. But, you know, we could get into the whole question of whether TV is a wasteland or not. But the but the issue, because I think there's some great stuff on TV.
Sure.
But what happened between the late 50s into the 2000s, which we might call, or I would say maybe the 90s, the broadcast era, the history of television in terms of broadcast era, that was a period from around 1960 when the when Congress got really upset about violence in television and the quiz show scandals, till the late 90s when cable began to rear its head, maybe early mid-80s. That was a point where the networks had enormous power. Okay, so from that standpoint, they were able to say to advertisers, screw off, you know? And it's not like advertising as a system didn't affect television. In fact, it did, just as you pointed out. The major consequence that advertisers have for television during that era is the networks know they have to draw huge numbers of people, and the way they do that is to make shows that aren't going to depress people. But before that, and in radio, we had advertisers literally controlling the nature of the shows.
Yeah.
Okay? Making sure that they were – that, for example, at one point Coca-Cola didn't want – people who are not adults drinking Coke in a certain TV show because they thought it would infantilize Coca-Cola. Or the great example of this, it's so funny that it's sad. The first version of Judgment in Nuremberg, which was about the Holocaust, was a television show. I don't know if you knew that. It was
no.
a drama on the networks in the mid-1950s. And it was supported, the particular series, I forget what it was, of dramas, those were the days when they had individual dramas, one a week, was supported by a gas company. And the gas company did not want them to mention gas chambers.
Oh, God.
They fought it through, and finally I think they were allowed to mention gas chambers. But it was that level of participation before the 60s. I would argue that in the magazine industry – And increasingly in the television industry, we are back to that era. There are so many magazines today where you cannot tell the difference between marketing and the actual editorial matter. When you see, for example, go to an airline magazine and they'll say the top things to do in Tucson. You know, I don't know if each one of those has been paid for.
Yeah.
And there are so many magazines where what appears to be editorial are frankly attempts by companies to make money in their interaction with their advertisers. We're seeing more and more of that laxness in the magazine industry and in television too. People forget that it was not until the 90s that the networks allowed – since the 60s that the networks began to allow product placement in TV. It really was, and believe it or not, the first example of this was Seinfeld, and Seinfeld wanted it there to make the show realistic. They weren't paid for putting, like, Rice Krispies in a Seinfeld episode. But over time, the networks, which had no longer had this requirement of their industry, and it's a bit of a long story why, to keep away from product placement, this has become a major issue. For them, they want more and more. Producers want product placement because it's a way to monetize, to make up for the difference of licensing between what they get from the networks and what it costs them to make an episode. And just to give you an example of how that's changing, a few weeks ago, how it changes shows. A few weeks ago, I read that I guess it's Ram Trucks has a deal with a new show called Longmire on the A&E network. As part, it's a long-term numbers of episodes deal, and as part of the deal, they're not only going to put the show in this series, just like I guess Chevy does with NCIS, but they're also going to have plot points written around the Ram trucks.
So the point, the larger point being that the church-state line hasn't been much of a line for a while,
right?
And now you're just saying it's getting worse online, and it's creeping in to affect the sort of last bastion of quality publishing.
It's certainly affecting the magazine industry. No, the business of quality publishing is the following. With the fall of newspapers, one of the reasons we could go into a whole lot of discussion about that, but one of the things that is pushing newspapers down on the web is the rise of what are pejoratively called content farms.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and these are companies that essentially use the search engine as the raison d'etre for creating stories.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, let's say I find that there's a lot of people today searching for parakeet food online.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I will then send a letter to my freelancers, make stories and videos about parakeets.
Mm-hmm.
And there are companies like – I'm sorry. At least we can say what's wrong with that.
No, I don't think – I mean, it's obvious what's wrong with that. It's pollution.
Yeah, well, and this is what's happening. So demand media puts out over 10,000 pieces a day, video and regular,
mm-hmm.
with the hope that they will be caught in search engines. And, of course, mm-hmm. by doing that, the people who write this get very little money.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to produce things that are basically rip and read, kind of cut and paste.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes the whole idea of what it means to tell stories
and
what professionalization means.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But
now,
the
Google has been trying to work against this with
mm-hmm.
pressure from the newspaper people. It has somewhat succeeded, but certainly not by a whole lot.
So now I'm going to ask you a meta question, because I mean I don't think we disagree at all that this is all troubling, that people ought to opt in rather than have to opt out,
uh-huh.
and that if somebody else is making money off of your data, maybe the consumer should be put in the driver's seat somehow and
mm-hmm.
decide, if they, A, want other people to access that data, and then B, how they want to shape that transaction,
right.
which is, instead of it being a one-way decision by the marketer, where you, the individual, ought to have a bit more leverage in that. But
mm-hmm.
just for argument's sake, the argument that's been made from a whole bunch of people about the rise of the read-write web, right, which is to say
mm-hmm.
even though, the big companies, whether it's the owners of the pipes like AT&T and Verizon or the big mm-hmm. content companies, all imagine the web just to be this amazing new vehicle for, selling crap, if you will, to people, that they're going to push content at us and we'll just click and buy their movies, online or whatever,
mm-hmm.
that you can write to the web. You don't only have to read. So we're seeing the rise of what Henry Jenkins calls the participatory culture.
Right.
And that, there's this immense flowering of user-generated content. Mm-hmm. And, my friend Scott Hefferman, who started Meetup, likes to say, that the big shift that's underway is people are turning away from mass entertainment, mass culture, and towards each other, or as he likes to put it, instead of, watching The Biggest Loser on TV, we're talking about our Biggest Loser friend on Facebook with each other, okay?
Okay.
And so the argument there is, in a way, that yes, everything you're saying, Joe, is right, but that many of us are already elsewhere. We're already, kind of using the tools to entertain and educate ourselves, so in some ways the decline of the old media system is irrelevant to people who are creating their own media. What do you say to that?
I'm glad you asked the question. I think it's a great question, and I try to address it in the beginning of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Two things, I don't disagree with people like Henry Jenkins and Yochai Benkler and others, that Clay Shirky, that there's enormous potential in the web and other and mobile devices and all for interaction. I think it happens all the time. I think to some extent it does give consumers power on many levels, creative and otherwise, even economic sometimes. But I really do think that people exaggerate that, or if they don't exaggerate it, they do it to the exclusion of talking about the kickbacks, the pushbacks that the marketing community and the big media community are having with respect to this. I think it's way exaggerated to think that we're all creating new stuff and spending our time getting into the literature of our friends. And by the way, even that stuff, while it's going on, is fodder for marketers in terms of how they think about you. Okay? Go to your friendly blog site, and they're still using Google to make money off of it.
Yeah.
All right? And so they're not mutually exclusive, these two things. Secondly,
but the ad site is making money too. I mean, in that case, the blogger, not that many bloggers are making that much money from Google AdWords, but at least
they're making money. Right, but what I'm saying, in the process of doing that, they are contributing to the kinds of stuff I was talking about. So that Google is using all of these blogs for its own purposes, okay? So I don't think processes are mutually exclusive. But
I agree with you that but at the same time that the person is blogging, for argument's sake, yes, it's a huge trade-off, right? That, you know, in effect, this is what, you know, being living in public online does, which is, on the one hand, yes, you to some degree are the product that other people are monetizing, and they may be doing it in ways that are invisible and invidious. On the other hand, you may benefit from being highly networked online. You may benefit from
Absolutely, and I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just saying that people haven't paid enough attention to the kinds of stuff I'm talking about. If you read people like Jenkins, if you read people like Benkler and Shirky, they never mention it, okay? Yochai hardly ever talks about advertising. Jenkins talks about it only as part of the process of creation, you know, how consumers can get involved in this kind of stuff. The whole idea that advertisers should be shaping this environment is really missing in almost all of these grand notions of what we can do. And the other thing I wanted to say is, you know what most people are doing when they're watching TV? Going online, often talking about TV.
Right.
I think the notion that we're all involved in high intellectual creativity is totally misguided. Most people just want to relax and do what they do. And a lot of what they do has to do with the web, you know, in terms of the monetized web, the business web. So I think there are no real hard numbers, to be honest, Micha, and it'd be interesting to try to take this apart. I would argue that at the core of the web today and the core of the development of the mobile system is marketing and advertiser support. And the use of the web for other purposes is certainly there. But the great proportion of activities, despite all of this, feeds in to marketers.
Right, right. And that furthermore, as we get, whether it's through your IP address or your freely sharing information about yourself that then third-party media buyers link up about you, or in the case of mobile phones, the fact that every mobile phone has a unique ID, the result is that marketers now have the ability to pinpoint individuals, and they don't have to, even if they want, spend anything on the so-called waste, whether that's individuals they don't want to market to or content that they don't want to support. So the result being that we're gonna sort of see the further hollowing out of editorial content that isn't totally linked to the financial reward that an advertiser sees connected to it.
Right, and what also is and what's also happening, and often people like Yochai Benkler don't point this out, is that the notion of news today in their view, is based on voluntarism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of it is based on people writing things. I mean, that was the essential motive behind Huffington Post, of course. And
mm-hmm.
while they certainly have hired journalists, they really, a huge proportion of what they do is links and people volunteering.
Right.
So, you know, essentially these are people who are – the same with demand media that I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
We have a situation where people are being paid nothing or very little to make billionaires of companies – that are allowing them to talk to one another and
mm-hmm.
to draw audiences for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, it, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of issues around that kind of thing, too. You mentioned the hollowing out. The hollowing out of the profession of journalism through the creation of these sorts of things. Now, I don't want to sound like a Luddite here. I think the Internet is terrific. I use it all the time. I use my
mm-hmm.
smartphone all the time. But I think that as a society, I also, as I started saying, I'm not against target marketing. I just think that if we're going to live in a society where information is the currency that surrounds us and that our reputations are being created through information, that we should know what's going on and have control over that. And
mm-hmm.
this is a very big issue because basically companies essentially are saying that they own our data about us.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you're creating those data all the time by what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost
mm-hmm.
a philosophical issue.
What would you do, you know, as we come towards the last part of our call, and again, I'm pausing just to see if anyone wants to ask a question. You should jump in, hit star six.
You can be angry at me if you like.
Sometimes people are shy, so I'm just going to keep going and unless
all
someone
right.
jumps in. But what would you do as, I mean, are there legislative remedies? Here, you know, I worry about, you know, saying the government should fix this problem because
yes.
a lot
right.
of people in government have very little understanding about how the Internet works. They're often,
yeah.
You know, you see these panicked,
mm-hmm.
You know, crusades about children being exposed to pornography or
yeah.
or. You know, bullying, or you know, there are a couple of versions
yes.
of this that continually
right.
crop up, and that isn't a very conducive environment for you know, making sound legislation. At the same time, it's clear that the Electronic Communications Privacy Act is woefully out of date, and we're just
yeah.
beginning to hear some discussion now of you know, enabling the do not track option. In a more visible way for web users. What do you think of that? You know, does it go far enough? Is it just a sort
well,
of a fig leaf?
Well, I agree with you about a number of things. I would not prefer for the government to have huge amounts of control over the web and over what companies do. However, I think that the a lot of times bad actor competition forces certain kinds of activities on companies that often they wouldn't do if it weren't for that. I mean, all you have to do is look at an example. There are things that Google is now doing with data that 5 years ago they were proud to say they didn't do,
mm-hmm.
connect various databases and things
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
We will see over the next decade or so far more use of data about us than we've ever seen. Now, the Europeans are trying to take a tougher stance on this, and
mm-hmm.
and it'll be interesting to see how the Americans, the U.S. government is trying to finesse a kind of relationship with Europe in terms of defining human rights and privacy in certain ways that allow companies to work across the pond, as it were. But I guess my feeling is that the government should encourage and maybe sometimes legislate ground-level things
mm-hmm.
that we can all agree ought to take place. And then partly because the better companies would prefer to have a level playing field
mm-hmm.
so that they would not have to do things that they really don't necessarily want to do. I think that do not track in a real way, meaning really don't track, don't just tell me you're not going to send the ads to me,
mm-hmm.
is useful.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that, I mean, a lot of companies are scared of this idea. Because they believe that if you say do not track means you can't really follow a person, it's going to make it impossible for them to make money. Because, frankly, the distinguishing characteristic between the web and other media is this ability to really track people. I mean, that's what it comes down to. I don't think that's the case. I think that companies will easily find ways for people to opt in. Sometimes it may simply mean bribing them. You know, you can't go to this site unless you let us do it. But I think the more companies are encouraged to allow people to understand their data and to get into their data and to find out how companies got their data and are using the data, the better it is long term, not just for society, but for the advertising industry.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe that eventually, not now, not in the next few years, eventually people are going to realize that they're being maltreated in some ways, that their data are being shared in ways that they don't like. And I don't know that we'll have an Occupy Madison Avenue that we had by Wall Street, but we will have certain incidents that cause large numbers of people to say, this is ridiculous. And the blow up may be larger than what Madison Avenue wants. I really do believe that ground level regulation, and years ago I had an idea of something called a dashboard, a privacy dashboard, which allows, the idea would be to allow you to go in and find out when an ad is targeted to you, not just what the icon says, here you can go and find out how you can opt out, but it would tell you, why did we send you this? Literally, we sent you this because you're a soccer mom. Here are the factors which may have led to us calling you a soccer mom.
Right.
Here are the sites that you visited that led us to see. So you really begin to be part of the process. And particularly for the younger generation, which knows nothing about this. You know, everyone talks about how young people understand the new media. I have them in my classes all the time. They don't understand anything under the hood about how the web operates. So the more our society gets used to the idea that there is this world that we know about and can work with, the less passive that we'll be about how we define ourselves and how we let other people define ourselves.
No, I think that's right. We know of a few interesting hacks coming also. I mean, I think there are people who are looking at this ecosystem, you know, the degree to which it is, you know, it's kind of sneaky what's being done here, and you know, there is the internet can also turn on these kinds of systems in ways that could be very upsetting to advertisers.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Can you be more specific?
I'd actually rather not talk about it until the people who are working on this are ready. It's quite possible this will be something announced at our conference in June.
That's great.
The truth is that you know, the good news, I would say, I wonder if you agree, as we just come to a conclusion, is that to some degree this is still a competitive landscape, and you know, it isn't as if we are all locked into using Google or Facebook. At the moment, they both have very strong market positions. But, you know, as you point out, they're only a few years old, and many of the services that people use today are you know, very new. And, you know, 5 years ago, everybody was saying how dominant MySpace was. Look where MySpace is now.
Yeah, I agree with you. But, yeah, let me – two caveats, if I may, though. One is the way venture capitalists look at the world. They want to know eventually how you're going to monetize it. And unfortunately, a large part of monetization today resides in advertising. I think it's getting crazy. I think it's overdone. Sooner or later, and this is beginning to happen, people are actually going to have to pay for it. And of course, we pay more and more for lots of things. I don't want to say we don't. But the second thing I'd like to say is that one word that I hear used too often, you didn't use it, but pretty well lots of other people use it, the word creepy. They say, I find this stuff creepy. And the reason I don't like it, not that I don't identify with the emotion sometimes, is creepy means I don't understand. Okay? The word creepy means that I don't have a good reason to say I don't like it, but I just simply don't like it.
Right.
It's an emotional phrase. We have to get to a point where we can talk intelligently about the specifics of how this works and say why we don't like the particulars of it. as a society. And that's what's missing. We're kind of illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is that the language that's used is sometimes purposefully obfuscatory.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard people in ad meetings say, my boss doesn't understand what I'm doing. And people have railed against the language that media buyers and planners use because they say it covers up more than it reveals.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another agenda that we have to say, this isn't rocket science, but explain it to us.
Right. Right, you know, right, and that's where the media is also. I think we the people whose job it still is to explain this to us, you know, we're in a little bit of a race against time here, because as more of those people discover that actually for financial reasons it might not be something that their
exactly.
publisher wants them to talk
right.
about, then we enter a very dark hole. Which could be kind
it's
of scary.
It's very problematical, even for our best newspapers.
Very interesting. Well, listen, Joe, this has really been great. I enjoy
talking with you, Mike.
I enjoy talking with you. Again, folks, you've been listening to the Personal Democracy Plus conference call. Today we've been talking with Joseph Turow, whose new book, The Daily You, is really an excellent and to some degree chilling guide into this brave new world of media buyers and ad networks and what they're tracking and doing with all that information that you spin off as you use the web. So something that people need to be much more literate and aware of. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And thank you to Joe. And
good day.
We'll see you online.